Hope your Thanksgiving was everything you hoped it would be. It's kind of one of the great holidays of the year, and it's one that has an important purpose. It reminds us that our accomplishments and our acquisitions are not the main thing. That there is one who gives gifts, unexpected gifts, to whom we should be thankful. And it's easy to get caught up doing every other thing, but hopefully you spent some time in God's presence thanking Him for what He has done for you that often goes unnoticed by us. We don't take enough time to be thankful. What we're talking about in biblical language is blessing, the blessings of God. And that's actually the subject of the text we're going to study this morning, beginning in verse 8 of 1 Peter 3. We're going to talk about blessing. How does it come to us? What are the choices and the opportunities and the direction to face in order for God's blessing to kind of enter our experience? And we're going to do a bit of a flyover. We're going to cover more material than usual today, and some of it we'll have to skip or just touch very lightly. But I think the important question is, how will God give His presence to us, His best gifts to us, His grace to us? How will we become those who receive His blessing? We've already noted many times as we've gone through this book that it is written to sojourners, those who are called to live in a place and a time and among people and in all that happens in the world we live in, called to this place in the world, but our main loyalties are not here. We're loyal to a greater king. Our character is shaped by truth that this world doesn't know. We need to be here as servants, but we don't belong here forever. That's one of the big ideas of this book. And primarily, to this point, Peter's saying that our choices as sojourners serve as witnesses to the world. That they will see something different. And the call to be different is an opportunity for us to be light and salt and to stand out and for others to be attracted to what we know. But in this case, the emphasis Peter wants to make is, how will God do good to us in the choices we make and the lives we're called to? How will He give us the best things? So we are to be those who, and there's two paragraphs we'll consider mostly. The first one says, those has as its center idea that we are eager to do good. The work of servants and healers, compassion, humility, turning the other cheek. Eager to do good even when it costs us. And at the end of verse 9, Peter writes, because to this you were called so that you may inherit a blessing. And then in the next paragraph that has this sentence from verse 14, but even if you should suffer for what is right, you are blessed. And how does blessing come to us when we're suffering? So we are those eager to do good, and therefore receiving a blessing from God, and so receiving a blessing from God. We are those who endure suffering when it's required of us and find that that is a place of blessing as well. So let me begin in verse 8, and we'll read this first paragraph, this first set of verses, and consider what we're being taught here. Verse 8 of chapter 3 of 1 Peter. Finally, all of you live in harmony with one another. Be sympathetic. Love as brothers. Be compassionate and humble. Do not repay evil with evil or insult with insult, but with blessing. Because to this you were called, that you may inherit a blessing. For whoever would love life and see good days must keep his tongue from evil and his lips from deceitful speech. He must turn from evil and do good. He must seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and His ears are attentive to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Who's going to harm you if you are eager to do good? Now, the way of life that's sort of presented to us here is attractive to everyone, isn't it? I mean, if the question is, as is presented to us in verse 10, whoever would love life and see good days, if we're given a path to the place where we can love the lives we live and see good days, and our days are delightful to us, and our life is that one which we love. Well, everybody wants that. That's kind of attractive to all of us, isn't it? And the wisdom on what makes such a life possible is very old. Actually, most of this paragraph is a quote from Psalm 34, 1,000 years before Peter wrote these, quoted it, 1,000 years before the time of Christ and the beginning of the life of the church. From ancient times, the notion that humility and service and godliness and care for other people and giving oneself away, that those produce a life worth living. Those thoughts go way back. That being a good person leads to living a good life. But as old as those thoughts are, they sound out of date to us, to our ears, don't they? They're certainly not the contemporary take on things. Among us, in the place and time we live, and kind of the wisdom of the age, our age, what's sold to us as the way to love life and see good days? As it turns out, this is not so naive. It's not so old-fashioned. It's not out of date. A good life comes from aiming at something higher than commitment to tolerance. Character and humility and contentment actually do go together. Spending oneself for others, the power of empathy, the golden rule, although those things seem kind of rejected and unappreciated in the world around us, they still are the way to a life that is blessed by God and is worth living in our own experience. These things were once taught in the wider culture, but in too many cases they've been replaced by the acquisition folks taught in school and commanded by the thinkers of our time. A better way forward, they say, is the acquisition of data and technique, skills training, self-awareness, and management of one's feelings. That these are the ways to happiness. These are the ways to fulfillment. Is it still true that repaying evil and insult with kindness is the path to blessing? That those who would love life and see good days should be those of honest speech and generous deeds in the pursuit of peace. Spending yourself for someone else. Choosing the things of God rather than the things of our own flesh. Caring about someone. Living sacrificially for another. Refusing to let another's pain hurt us, but offering some word of hope in the place of their pain. Is it worth trying to live that way? Does anything good come of it? Let me make two more observations, and then I want to tell you a Jesus story. The first is that this is not what Peter's advocating here, is that being a good person leads to contentment, leads to a life that has God's blessing, is not the same as karma. He's not saying whistle a happy tune and everything will be okay. He's not saying that niceness inevitably brings about niceness. That's not the point at all. Verse 12, in fact, is clear. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous and his ear attentive to their prayers. It is because God is involved and sees what we're doing and hears our prayer and strengthens us to serve and gets us involved in the lives of other people and allows us to spend ourselves for someone else. It's because God is involved and hears our prayer that he fills our life with himself, and the person who makes selfless choices becomes a person of substance and has their heart filled with blessing. Eagerness to do good brings about a love of life and the seeing of good days because God is involved and answers our prayers. And a second observation we can make here is that this isn't a hobby. Being a good person every now and then, you know, doing a nice thing periodically and you know, when you get around to it. That's not what's in view here at all. He's saying that the person being described in these verses is a person that pursues peace. A person that spends himself or herself in compassion for other people. Who is humble at heart and involved with others and listens well. Someone who's eager to do what is good. Not someone that just occasionally dabbles in a good deed here and there. So God is in the midst of this, hearing our prayers and answering them. We are eager to be involved in seeing the world become a better place. And in the result of all these things is that we are blessed. We wake up looking forward to the day. We sense God's approval. We know that the things we're attending to are worth doing. We don't feel wasted or bored or useless. Loving life, seeing good days. Well, I want to tell you a Jesus story. In the final days before his death, he traveled from the region of the Transjordan in the east, and he traveled up one of the main roads, and he headed towards Jerusalem, and he was on his way to die. And he had to go through Jericho, because Jericho was on the road. And it says in Luke's account of this, at the end of chapter 18 and the beginning of chapter 19 of Luke, Jesus met two people. And the name of the blind man, the first that he met, is Bartimaeus. Mark tells us that. Probably because the man was known to those in the church, early church. This man, blind man that Jesus met, named Bartimaeus, was probably someone who followed Christ fully into the life of the church after Jesus died. And there's a crowd of pilgrims around Jesus. They're also going up to Jerusalem, also for the Passover, religious people. And they're on this way traveling, and they're listening to Jesus speak, and there's a crowd of them around, and there's a beggar who's blind by the side of the road. And he cries out, having heard who it is that's walking by, someone told him, "Look, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." And he's one of those kind of beggars, you've probably met some, that don't be quiet when they're told to be quiet. And the crowd tries to shush him up. And he yells all the more. And he's more disruptive. And he's more insistent. And he's angry or loud in any case. And most of the crowd, religious people all, pilgrims all, on their way to Jerusalem, going to worship at the Passover, listening to Jesus talk, want nothing to do with this guy. And Jesus hears him cry and stops the crowd and calls for the man to be brought to him. He's acting different than all the others around him, of course, as so often was the case. And then he does a strange thing. He says, "What do you want me to do for you?" And it's obvious to everyone what he wants. He is a beggar. He wants money. That's what beggars want. He's crying out, "Stop. Alms for the poor." And this guy startles everyone by saying, "Give me my sight. Son of David, have mercy on me." And Jesus hears faith in the man's angry voice. He realizes there's brokenness there that no one else could see. And what would it have been like to be blind all your life and walked by and shushed and not paid attention to? And Jesus offers the man, grants the man his sight. And then it says, in a voice as loud as the one he yelled as an irritant, he begins to glorify God. Same voice. Same volume. Now the call in 1 Peter is eagerness to do good. Compassion. Humility. Involvement. Other-centeredness. Getting ourselves out of the way so that we can engage with folks who are broken. But we got to be able to hear. We can't make assumptions that we always know what's going on. The word compassion is a powerful word. What would it be like to live in someone else's shoes, someone like this? To not assume we always know? And Jesus is offering his disciples who are walking along after him an example of an eagerness to do good, an alertness to the opportunity. Well, the second half of the story, Jericho, he's entering Jericho, he meets Bartimaeus. Actually, there were two blind men, but only one is mentioned particularly in Luke, and they enter, go on into the town. And there's this same crowd, sort of a barrier around Jesus, same group of religious folks. And Jesus stops under a tree. And there was a guy in the tree who was a man small of stature named Zacchaeus. Also named, by the way, I think because he also was a person known to the folks in the early church. Not every healing, not every miracle of Jesus, not every involvement of Jesus ends up naming the person who's a recipient. But often when it does, it's because that person continued on in faith. Now Zacchaeus, it says, was a tax collector, which means he was a turncoat. He was someone who had turned on his people and sold them out to the Romans and was now working for the Romans and helping the Romans extort onerous taxes from the people. And he knew the territory and he knew how to be able to say, well, I know where the rich widow is who's pretending to be poor, but she has money and I can help you get her money. He had sold out his people. He was a desperately lonely man. And it says of him that he was small of stature, and that's why he had climbed a tree to see Jesus. But it's saying something else maybe too. Have you known boys growing to be men who were always too small to be noticed or cared about or respected for whatever reason? Extreme diminutive size, for boys especially, later men, can be a sense of frustration and being on the sideline and not invited and not cared about and not believed in and not listened to. And this man turned on his people and sold them out to Rome. But you wonder, had somebody turned on him when he was young? And what did Jesus see that no one else saw? There's this crowd of pilgrims that have forced Zacchaeus to the periphery and made him climb a tree. And Jesus stops and said, today, your house, your guest. I will honor you by treating you with respect and see in you what you can't see in yourself and no one else can. Zacchaeus, come down. I want to be your friend. And his world changed. And he gave back all that he'd stolen and four times as much. And he was won back from the isolation and the loneliness and the nothing like the beggar. He had all the money in the world, but he had no place in the world. And Jesus gave him a place. Now, all this happened in one day, evidently. Just walking through Jericho, on the way into and through Jericho, and Jesus can see what no one else can see, and stops where no one else will stop, and understands what no one else understands, and enters into brokenness and need and hurt and sorrow. He's eager to do good, and he's given us a pattern for it. We're making our way through the world too, and it's filled with hurting souls. And most of the time, they're that way for a reason. They got there by ways that we could understand if we took the time to understand and do something about it. And very often, they want something that even they can't articulate. Not just alms for the poor person. You know, here's a couple of bucks, go away. You know, not just sermons for the turncoat and the bad guy, but some sort of reaching out to and understanding the bad guy and the dangerous man. So Peter is making the argument that engagement, kindness, a willingness to take the insults that are hurled at us by others and the dangerous deeds of men like Zacchaeus who are affronting the people of God and instead of giving back insult, giving back something better, doing all of that stuff changes the world, sure, but it changes us. It makes us the kind of people we want to be. We want to be people and know ourselves to be people who participate with the Lord in shining the light where it had not been shined. And that's the way to blessing. It's not by focus on ourselves, it's focus on someone else. There's a second paragraph that discusses how blessing occurs, and it begins in verse 14. And he says here that suffering and blessing are aligned. Verse 14, but even if you should suffer for what is right, you are blessed. Do not fear what they fear. Do not be frightened But in your heart, set apart Christ as Lord. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. But do this with gentleness and respect, keeping a clear conscience so that those who speak maliciously against your good behavior in Christ may be ashamed of their slander. For it is better, if it is God's will, to suffer for doing good than to do for doing evil. For Christ died for sins once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. So the condition here is that eagerness to do good doesn't lead to a good outcome. That having been kind-hearted to someone like Zacchaeus, he doesn't come down the tree and let you in his house, he throws you in jail. That the involvement with serving others and the healing of Christ and the good thing actually gets you in trouble. That happens. Happened to Jesus, it happens. So what happens when a righteous deed leads to suffering circumstances? Well, here's where the blessing comes. Because when we suffer, we have an opportunity to overcome fear. That's the first idea. Don't be afraid of what they're afraid of. Don't fear what they fear. The person who remains victimized by terrible fears is the person that never is quite willing to face them. Oh, what if the worst thing happens? I need to avoid the worst thing. I need to stay huddled and closed in and bottled up and covered up and distant. But when we suffer, we realize as God is with us in the suffering, the very thing we feared the most is not so fearsome anymore. And it's exactly what Charles Wesley wrote, by the way, in the Come Thou Long Expected Jesus. From our fears and sins release us. Break the power of fear that keeps us from being who we are. And it's suffering breaks the power of fear. Having experienced hard things, we realize they don't kill us. They don't end anything. That God is more real to us. Many of you love the Lord of the Rings trilogy, the great, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien's masterpiece. And if you only saw the movie, didn't read the book, you don't realize there's another part that got left out at the end. The very end of the story, the hobbits go back to the Shire. And there's four of them who have fought orc lords and Nazgul and have engaged in awesome deeds. And once they were little hobbits in the Shire, afraid of everybody else outside. And now these warriors come back and they realize their people are being bullied by a guy named Saruman and some of his thugs. And these four hobbits who aren't afraid of anything anymore rout the bullies, humiliate those who would have once humiliated them. They aren't afraid anymore, is the point. They've been through terrible circumstances, and there is no bully on the order of Saruman, the defeated, who is going to make me afraid anymore. Peter is saying that entering into hardship and finding God there breaks the power of sin to cramp us and destroy us. He says that we should set apart Christ as in our hearts, set apart in our hearts Christ as Lord in times of suffering. We'll find ourselves hearing the voice of Jesus inside us, drawing on the power of the Spirit for strength we do not have when we're suffering. It's only when we avoid suffering, we never test the power of God, do we, when we avoid suffering. If we don't need him absolutely, we won't trust him absolutely. When we're hurting, we trust him. And we find that he is there and his power is available to us and his presence is a comfort to us. Setting apart Christ as Lord in our hearts when it's hard. So suffering becomes a source of blessing to us as well. Grand new discoveries of the presence and purpose of God. I want to tell you another story. Briefly, you may remember in Acts 16 the account of Paul and Silas in Philippi. They were there as servants of the Lord preaching the gospel, and one day they encounter, finally, are made to see the plight of a girl who was demonized and lived in the dark pit of demon association in her own life and then was used by men to make money. This is not far off from the kind of sex trafficking and drug related kind of terrorizing of young girls that happens in our world. It's not, we can sort of see what her life would have been like if we use our imaginations. And finally, the gospel intervenes and Paul and Silas banish the demon, and she's no longer any use to her masters. They can't make money anymore off her fortune telling. And so they have a row and they drag Paul and Silas into this kangaroo court, lie about them. They have no chance to defend themselves. They are beaten in public. They are beaten with rods. They their wounds are untreated. They are thrown into jail, not into jail alone, but into jail in the stocks, in the inner jail, in the darkest place. And then at midnight, the darkest hour of the darkest place in the stocks, beaten, bleeding, what do? Sing. They're praying and singing hymns at midnight in the jail in Philippi. It was so dark they couldn't see anything else, we assume. No miracles yet happen. A miracle's coming, but no miracles yet happen. They're singing before the miracle. And the reason they're singing is because they have nobody but Jesus by now. But they have him, and he's going to do something. He's not forgotten them, and they know it. They can't sleep in the circumstances they're in. They can't rest, so let's sing and pray and honor God. And everybody listens, the fellow prisoners, the jailer. And as Peter says in this text, people are going to ask you about this stuff. You better have an answer for what they say when they ask you, because they're going to ask. They're going to ask what makes people like this. And there's a great story of this jailer, this hard-bitten Roman veteran whose heart is made gold by his discovery of these things. And he washes their wounds and sets them on their feet and comes to Christ himself. So, suffering is a source of blessing to us because we will discover the Lord in ways we cannot discover him if we never are called on to live in circumstances too hard for us. Our fears will always grip us until they're defeated. So, what Peter's saying is, you know, if we want a life that's worth living, we want a sense of God's gifts and presence, if we want some joy and enthusiasm and looking forward to what's next, be eager to do good. And when suffering comes, set Christ apart as Lord in your hearts. Draw on his presence in a way you haven't before, and we find blessing. Now, there's two other paragraphs that we're going to go over quickly. For a couple of reasons. One is not enough time to say everything there is to say in any book of the Bible for that matter. But these are two difficult paragraphs, actually interpretively difficult. The final verses of chapter 3 and the opening verses of chapter 4. And they're difficult for a couple of reasons. One is we don't exactly know. Peter probably is referring to something that was common knowledge to his hearers and himself, but we don't quite know what it is. And he hearkens all the way back to the time of Noah in the paragraph that ends chapter 3. Which is so far removed from us in time, it's hard to be certain of. And we just can't quite be certain we know what we're dealing with entirely with all here. But the big idea is easy to be certain about. The big idea in this chapter and then in the opening six verses of chapter 4 is that neither the eagerness to do good in service of Christ nor the suffering for his namesake are the end of the story. The tribunal that sent Silas and Paul into the Philippian prison is not the last tribunal. The last voice judging everything is Jesus' voice. We enter into suffering and we find him, and he was a sufferer before we were, and we know him better as a result. But he is not only a sufferer, he is also the victor. He is the one who is going to stand at the end, judge of all, raising us up, honoring us with him, calling us brother to him and granting us honor. We know that he wins the victory, and that's what informs all our willingness to trust him in the moment for all the things that we don't understand yet. So I'm going to just read a part of the last paragraph in chapter 3, trying to summarize what I think the big point is. He went and preached to the spirits in prison. These are probably demons or the offspring of demons in the time of Noah who have been imprisoned waiting for Jesus raised from the dead to speak to them in victory. And he went and pronounced victory over those defeated dark spirits. And at the end of the chapter, chapter 3, he has gone into heaven and is at God's right hand with angels, authorities, and powers in submission to him. The Lord who lives in us is the Lord who will ascend and has ascended and someday will be seen to have ascended and rule over every power and authority, absolutely, absolute dominion. We're not trusting someone who can't deliver on his promises. The first 6 verses of chapter 4, let me read these words as a summary of that section. For you have spent enough time in the past doing what pagans choose to do, living in debauchery, lust, drunkenness, orgies, carousing, and detestable idolatry. They think it's strange you don't plunge with them into the same flood of dissipation, and they heap abuse on you. You used to be one kind of person. You're not that kind of person anymore. And your old running mates don't understand why you're different, and they abuse you for being different. But they will have to give an account of him who is to judge the living and the dead. Again, the announcement is that Jesus is not just our companion in the difficult time, but he is the one who someday will call everyone to account. So we are eager to do good as his servants. We are willing to suffer as his servants. We are certain that whatever tribunal, whatever voice, whatever accusation, whatever command or power that insists that it knows what it's doing in this life is someday going to answer to him. And so we follow him. We hear in the voice on the side of the road, not just someone that wants money, someone that wants life. We see the guy in the tree who's so broken and lonely and screwed up, he doesn't know which way to turn. But he wished someone would care for him. We're not afraid when they say jails and beatings and stocks. We know that those who would vaunt themselves against Jesus will someday face him and hear a word of their judgment. And we know the way to live the life that we want to live is to follow Jesus, caring for what he cares for, obeying what he calls us to do. The end of the story. He has gone into heaven and is at God's right hand with angels, authorities, and powers in submission to him. And we have a chance to be in submission to him now. Let's pray. Lord, we want to live lives that make a difference. And we want to look forward to the day and wake up with some sense that it's worth being us. And we know the way to blessing is not to serve ourselves, but to spend ourselves for your sake. Help us, Lord, in Jesus' name.